January of last year, BuzzFeed reported some of the contents of an explosive document that has come to be known simply as the Trump dossier. It had been compiled by a former British intelligence officer and contained serious allegations about Donald Trump's illicit ties to Russia, with claims ranging from the salacious to the disturbing. But the details and the veracity of the dossier have been hotly debated, in part because very little has been known about either the author or how he came to compile this information. My first guest today has published an investigation that gives us far greater understanding on both of these questions. Jane Mayer is an investigative reporter and staff writer for The New Yorker. She covers politics, culture, and national security. She's the author of Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right, which was named one of The New York Times' 10 Best Books of 2016. And her latest article in The New Yorker is titled The Man Behind the Dossier, How Christopher Steele Compiled His Secret Report on Trump's Ties with Russia. I spoke with Jane Mayer in March, and we are rebroadcasting that conversation for you now. So there is a great deal to talk about here. You have many revelations in your article, so we'll try to get to as many of them as we can. But I guess, can you start by just sort of recapping the origins of this dossier? I mean, so it's authored by Christopher Steele through his private company, Orbis Intelligence, correct? Just kind of set the stage
for us. Right. He had been at MI6 for about 20 years, where he was an expert in Russia. He'd been an undercover espionage agent in Moscow from 1990 to 93, and he speaks fluent Russian. And so this is his area of expertise. And it was so kind of an unusual person to find in the middle of American politics, really. Mm-hmm. But in the spring of 2016, he got a call from American operatives working for it turned out for the Clinton campaign, who wanted to investigate Trump's ties to Russia. And by then, he was out of the government and had his own little intelligence, business intelligence firm. And so he took the assignment.
But he wasn't hired directly by the Clinton campaign, right? There was a go-between.
Exactly. And this begins to sort of get to this issue, which has been very politicized. Trump's defenders have described Christopher Steele as a kind of a plant that was put in place by the Clinton campaign to besmirch Trump's name and to try to get the FBI to investigate Trump's ties to Russia. And so they've kind of described him as somebody who was a dirty trickster and who was allied politically and working for Hillary Clinton. And he was remotely working for Hillary Clinton, but the bizarre thing is that at first he didn't know it, because the people who approached him was another firm doing kind of political intelligence, which is the firm's called Fusion. It's a firm based in Washington. And Fusion, in turn, was working for a law firm. And the law firm was working for the Clinton campaign.
So
when Christopher Steele got called, so you've got these sort of layers of insulation between him and the Hillary Clinton campaign. He's not an idiot, so he could figure out he had a pretty high suspicion that when he was asked to look into Trump's ties to Russia, it was going to be somebody who was not in favor of Trump and likely Democrats. But he literally did not know it was the Clinton campaign. He thought he was a subcontractor to Fusion, and Fusion's client was a law firm. Right. So he knew he was working for a law firm.
And the Clinton campaign didn't know him either, right? I mean,
Well, that's the craziest thing of all. So it's come to be thought of it that he was, you know, doing this dirty work for Hillary Clinton. The truth is that that most of the people in the Clinton campaign, even the top people in the Clinton campaign, did not know anything about Christopher Steele until reports of him were published. They didn't see this document, this dossier, until January of 2017, which means, you know, after the election. He was doing this research, and it was being filtered up through these channels, and yet his kind of identity was kept from the campaign, kind of for legal protective reasons. And meanwhile, the most controversial thing in some ways that he did was he went to the FBI when he learned of these really, I think, concerning bits of information about Trump and the Russians. He took it to the FBI, but he did that completely on his own. Right. And he never spoke to the Clinton campaign about it. And the Clinton campaign did not realize through the whole campaign, there was, you know, all summer of 2016, there was an FBI investigation going on into Trump and Russia that was partly sparked by Christopher Steele. And the campaign was paying him, but didn't know anything about the investigation.
It's insane. I mean, as I think you quote someone from the campaign in your article saying, if we'd have known about this, we would have been screaming from the rooftops that the FBI was...
Yeah, I mean... Absolutely. And you know, I mean, there are plenty of reasons to be skeptical about whether the campaign might be telling the truth about this or covering its tracks. I mean, you know, there are reasons why in politics people don't always tell the truth. But in this case, that quote that you cited makes all the sense in the world. If the Clinton campaign knew that there was an investigation going on by the FBI into Trump in the summer of 2016, when Hillary Clinton was being accused all the time of, you know, being a crook, and the chant was "lock her up," and people and the FBI director Comey had this cloud over her head about whether there was a, you know, the investigation was open and closed and open and closed. During that whole period, if the Clinton campaign had known that Trump was under investigation himself, surely they would have said something, and that's what this person told me.
You're listening to Midday on WNYC. I'm speaking with Jane Mayer, the New Yorker staff writer, about her new investigation into Christopher Steele's dossier on the Trump campaign. And Jane, just quickly help us also understand, people who don't follow politics as closely may be wondering what we mean by this opposition research, this whole idea that that there's a espionage firm across the world being hired by political operatives in the United States to look up dirt on people. This is a standard part of American politics, right? This opposition research.
It is. It's considered kind of a, you know, the dark arts part of politics. But basically, you know, major politicians, candidates on both sides of the aisle do their best to find the dirt on the other side. And they're not looking for lies, because lies really aren't that handy. What they're looking for is true stories that could embarrass the candidate on the other side, you know, things that they've done wrong.
And it's legal. There's nothing illegal about that. It might be unsavory.
It is legal, but it's unsavory. It's legal, and the reason that for instance, somebody like Christopher Steele was kept behind this firewall, this legal firewall, working, you know, through these layers, was the campaign wants to be able to have some distance from it, and the candidate can say, well, I didn't know about that, or I didn't, you know, dig that up. In fact, it's people working for them three steps removed.
So let's talk a little bit about Christopher Steele himself, because, you know, he's been such a shadowy seeming character in all of this. We know so little about him before your piece. You mentioned that he was the Russia desk, had led the Russia desk for MI6. But I mean, you describe him sort of as sort of a mild mannered spy in Her Majesty's Secret Service is the impression I get. I mean, tell us a little bit about his background and who this guy is.
Well, so again, he's so different than the picture that's been painted of him by Trump and his defenders. I mean, Trump's called this dossier Steele's dirty dossier and said it's all tied into Hillary Clinton. In fact, Christopher Steele, first of all, I mean, I have to say, his lawyers will not let him speak to reporters because he's being sued for libel. So I had to put together the picture of him by talking to his friends, his business partner. Many people are quoted on the record in here who've known him throughout his life.
And he's being sued by libel. He's being sued for libel by who? By Donald Trump?
By a Russian businessman whose name is in the dossier, who Christopher Steele's dossier suggests was involved in hacking, doing the email hack of the Democrats.
Right.
And so he for legal reasons, he's been told not to give interviews. He also, as someone whose life has been mostly led in the shadows, he has to keep state secrets. So he can't really talk about many of the things he's done. But the picture of him that comes together is is as some very bright. He went to Cambridge. He was not from a rich family, but he was an outstanding student and very hardworking. A man who's people describe as having a ton of integrity, and who is, most of all, very English. He's not part of American politics. He's not a Hillary or a Trump person, particularly. His own politics run towards kind of supporting the Labour Party in England, but he's pragmatic. He's not terribly political. He's mostly interested in just getting the facts right, mm-hmm. and he's very worried about Russia. When he gets this assignment, he's been studying Russia for decades, and he sees Russia as becoming more and more meddlesome in Western democracies, and particularly in elections. And he's just finished a report on how Russia's been meddling in European elections. And that's when he steps into this assignment to look at America.
And he's been studying Russia for decades as the head of the Russia desk for MI6, right?
Yes, he's been first an undercover agent for MI6, and then as the head of the Russia desk. And he's very well respected within MI6. He's also had very, very close relations with the United States. He's briefed our former CIA director Michael Hayden in 2008. He's written reports that went directly to President Obama on Russia, because MI6 and the CIA share a lot of information. They're very closely allied. So he feels very closely allied with the United States. He's English, but he feels he's been a loyal ally and he wants to help. He's worried about what Russia's doing.
One of the sort of interesting asides about his work, and I guess the MI6 works in general in your piece, is this idea that their specialty is face-to-face sources, that Steele was as opposed to U.S. spying, we're more about intercepting data and communications, whereas Steele, his work was really about he had people on the ground in Russia. Is that an accurate understanding, or why is that important?
Absolutely. I mean, and the Americans might dispute it, but I've heard from many people that, you know, while the Americans have all of this signals intelligence, which comes from things like satellites and intercepts, all the technology, what the English are especially good at is developing on-the-ground sources face-to-face and, you know, a network of people that they can tap into who will tell them what's going on. And that's what his area of expertise was in this company. He had a network of sources in Russia that he could tap into.
And why is that important in terms of what we should think, or is that important what we should think about this dossier?
Well, what happened when Fusion, this American firm, comes to him and says, can you help us figure out what's going on with Trump in Russia? They'd hit kind of a dead end, and they needed someone who had people on the ground who could tell them more. They just couldn't figure out why. It seemed that there were Trump had gone to Russia a number of times over the years and was looking for business deals, but had come back empty-handed. And they were wondering, what's going on? Why does he keep going to Russia? What's he looking for? And what are his relationships like? And so Steele takes this on, and he's got this network of sources in Russia. And then he has a network that he's built up of people called collectors, who are people who've worked with him for years, who he pays as much as $2,000 a day to tap into these sources, talk to them, and see what kind of information they can get on Trump in Russia. These are people in Russia. Steele himself cannot really go to Russia anymore, it's worth saying. He was an undercover agent. His cover has been blown. He's known as a kind of, they describe him as an enemy of Mother Russia at one point. He can't really operate without calling attention to himself. But he's got this network that he can fire up that will get him information.
I'm Kai Wright. I'm speaking with New Yorker staff writer Jane Mayer about her story in the March 12th issue of the magazine, The Man Behind the Dossier. We're back with an interview I had with New Yorker writer Jane Mayer about her investigation into former British intelligence officer Christopher Steele and her piece, The Man Behind the Dossier. When we returned from the break, I asked her about Christopher Steele's role in uncovering the FIFA scandal and how it related to Donald Trump.
Yeah, so this is, again, something that's different from this picture of him that's been painted. People have suggested, who are on, you know, sort of on defending Trump, that he's just out to get Trump and it's all about politics. But in fact, he had stumbled over Trump's trail in a couple earlier cases. He's been in private business since 2009, and among the first cases he took on was this FIFA case, which has to do with the governing body of the soccer world and international soccer. And he's looking into bribery in this, you know, sports business, and he comes across what he thinks is this global corruption. It's so big, he's just looking at one little piece of it. His client is England, the English Soccer Association, but he realizes suddenly it's like huge. And so he could have just sort of done his part in his case and moved on, but instead he tipped off the FBI. He thought the FBI has the ability to do a kind of a global investigation. And when they did do this, and he worked with the FBI in the case, and it became a huge and very successful case, it turned out that one of the top people in the organization lived in Trump Tower. He was somebody who became an informant, and he lived a couple floors down from Donald Trump. So you've got this English investigator who's, you know, coming across Donald Trump's path, and then lo and behold, on his next case, he stumbles across Trump Tower yet again. And this is about it. He's working with the FBI on an international gambling ring, trying to crack it, where the head of the gambling ring, who's Russian, has fled the U.S., and there's an Interpol red notice out for him. And it turns out the gambling ring was based in Trump Tower, and the head of the gambling ring pops up unexpectedly in Moscow, sitting right next to Donald Trump at the Miss Universe competition in 2013, where Donald Trump is helping produce this Miss Universe competition. So at some point, even before Christopher Steele gets into the 2016 presidential campaign, he says to a friend who I interviewed, he says, it was as if all criminal roads seem to lead to Trump Tower. And yeah, he was beginning to wonder, like, who is this guy?
It's really quite striking, honestly. I mean, our colleagues here at WNYC, and they're producing a podcast called Trump Inc., where they're trying to follow the money. And I've been listening on the edge of my chair. And we constantly keep coming back to some sort of global financial crime that involves Trump Tower.
And it is really interesting. And then so Steele, as someone who is in the investigation business and particularly looking at Russia, comes across it because there are a lot of Russian connections to Trump Tower and to the Trump Organization. And so when he's asked about, can you do this assignment, by someone he knows in Washington who's working with this Washington firm, he says, sure, I'd like to take a look. And he's already aware that there are these odd sort of pings about Trump and this kind of world of Russian organized crime.
And it's, you know, I mean, you're describing this guy who's, he's got this real earnesty. He, you know, he really feels this patriotic duty to, you know, to report what he's finding to the FBI. I guess it's not patriotic, but, you know, this duty to tell somebody what he's finding. At the same time, I mean, how do we think about the fact, I mean, he's also kind of cashing in on his service with this company in the first place. You know, I mean, I think that's part of what makes it feel shady, you know? I mean,
yeah, it's a commercial business, and not all of his clients are going to be good guys, including, you know, one of his clients is an oligarch, I think. This is not his client, but he works for a law firm, and it's rumored that this law firm represents a Russian oligarch named Oleg Deripaska, who has quite a reputation for being a tough guy and you know, rough customer. And so they're not, you know, I don't think that you can say that, I mean, I think you can say that Christopher Steele is in the world of commerce now. It's a gray world of gray ethics. He's come out of the black and white world of, you know, good guys versus bad guys as he sees it. It was, you know, he was with the the West, and he was trying to fight Russian corruption and authoritarianism, and but he likes to work with the FBI, and he's continued to do that throughout his commercial career, and they seem to respect him highly. They give him a lot of interesting cases to work on, and I guess he's very good at them. So he's kept one foot in that world, and he's standing kind of in with one foot in both worlds when he's working, remotely for the Clinton campaign. He's going to the FBI, he's tipping them off about Trump, and then he's also looking at opposition research for the campaign.
So that's all about Steele. Let's talk a little bit about what he actually was finding and what's in this dossier. Maybe start with sort of as he's writing some early memos on it. What's this kind of information that he's coming across?
Well, so he thought he would just find a few dodgy business deals, and as soon as his collectors come back with the information about in early June of 2016 of what they're saying about Donald Trump in Russia, he's shocked. He says basically, "Oh my God, what is this?" and calls in his partner, Christopher Burrows, who I interviewed, who said, "Oh my God, this is a hot potato. What are we going to do with this thing?" And what they're looking at is this early, even the first report has these details that suggest that Trump has behaved in ways sexually in Russia. He's engaged prostitutes. According to some of the sources, he has had these prostitutes do this bizarre thing where they urinate on the bed in the Moscow Ritz-Carlton.
Presumably
in the
presidential
suite.
Presumably because the Obamas had visited there.
Had stayed in. And it was like a statement of contempt towards the Obamas to have these prostitutes, pee on the bed. And that's in this report. And supposedly this kind of behavior has been recorded by the Russian security police, who secretly record everything in hotel rooms. And so the inference or the suggestion in this report is that the Russians have the ability to blackmail Trump.
And I mean,
which is like something out of a spy novel, right? It just doesn't seem possible.
It doesn't, actually. It feels really quite mysterious and epic, and that's the piece of information that really has gotten so much news, right? Because it's so salacious. How did Steele deal with that piece of information? He kind of knew it was going to be a bombshell, right?
Right, and so he and his partner, it's a small firm they've got, and they're really just these two founding partners, and the partner had also come out of MI6, and he's a slightly older and conservative fellow, and so they have an argument over whether to include this thing that people refer to as the Golden Showers episode in the report that they're going to send on up to the campaign, to the law firm. They don't even know it's a campaign at that point. But they argue about it because the partner, Chris Burrows, says, the impact of this thing is going to be really huge. It's going to be controversial. It's going to be hard to handle. Are we sure we should put this in there? And Christopher Steele, who is really about as straight as people come, says, we have to put it in. The information is the information, and we can't tamper with it, and you can't cherry-pick it without distorting it, and we have to just pass it on. This is what the sources are saying. And they figure, we'll pass it on to this firm in Washington, and the firm can decide whether to take it out, because they're just subcontractors. So they pass it on. It's like raw intelligence. They've got seven sources in the first report, four of them on this Golden Showers thing, but they're all secondhand sources. They're people who've heard about it but haven't witnessed it. They pass it on. They send it back to Washington, along with quite a few other mind-boggling things that are in this first report, which have been lost in the shuffle because everybody's been focusing on the sex.
Well, let's talk about some of those things. But first off, just also, you said something there I want to draw attention to. You pointed out in the article that we kind of are understanding this dossier differently than it would be understood in the intelligence community, that we're sort of thinking of it as conclusions, but it's really kind of a notebook dump, right? Or Explain that.
It is. Kind of a notebook dump is a good way to put it. What it is interviews with people who are well-placed in Russia. They're people, they're described, their names are not in this report. The sources' identities are very fiercely guarded by this firm because these sources would be in danger. They could possibly face death sentences if their names were known. So, but they are people who are in places like, you know, the Kremlin, they're former officials, they are, and then some of them, in the case of this Golden Showers thing, are people who work in the Ritz-Carlton. Two people are in the hotel. So anyway, but what they are, it's talk. You know, it's hearsay. It's well-informed hearsay. And so you have to understand that when you talk about the credibility of the Steele dossier, it is what it is, which is a collection of very raw reporting on what people were saying they heard about Donald Trump in Russia.
And at what point, well, I'm sorry, before we get to what point he took it to the FBI, what else is in it? We've just give us a sense of beyond the sort of salacious, sexy stuff. You know,
really, in some ways, almost more important is even in the first Steele report, and by the end, there were, you know, something like 17 of these reports. But in the first one, he has information that says that for at least 5 years, the Russians have been trying to cultivate Donald Trump, and they're trying to win him over, and he's trying to cultivate them for business reasons. They have a deep kind of bond that they've been working on with each other. And according to the report, what the Russians have been doing is feeding Donald Trump opposition, research, dirt, whatever you want to call it, damaging information on Trump's opponents of all sorts, including Hillary Clinton.
But predating Hillary Clinton.
Predating Hillary Clinton. They've been giving him information on his rivals. And he's also been feeding them with information, apparently, according to these reports, on some of the Russians that he knows that are in America, you know, some of the oligarchs that are in America. Meanwhile, they want something from him. And they want something from the people around him. Especially once he started running for president, the one thing that runs through all these reports almost is what the Russians are looking for. They want to get these economic sanctions lifted off of them so that they can do business without the sanctions. And they want to be left alone to do whatever they want to do with Ukraine. And so they're looking for quid pro quos. In exchange for getting policy changes that they want, they're trying to give him dirt on Hillary Clinton and other opponents and trying to give him help in his election.
Is there any indication that it might also be about his search for capital? I mean, that's something that we've been reporting on, is that he was, you know, and that others, that a lot of reason he was in Russia so much was in search for money because he couldn't get traditional financing inside the United States anymore. Is there any indication that this sort of quid pro quo involved that?
Yes, there's lots of information on that. I mean, and these reports are very detailed, and they sort of lay out various schemes that these sources, through Steele's network, allege Trump was using to try to get money for his developments and for his business.
Yeah. So, moving on to sort of the Obama campaign or the Obama administration, when did they learn about this? What did they do about it?
Well, so this is the other thing that I tried to lay out in this story, because it's been portrayed as some kind of Democratic conspiracy between Hillary Clinton and this former spy and maybe the Obama administration too, the FBI working for the Obama administration. And to the contrary, what was shocking to me was President Obama and Vice President Biden did not learn about Christopher Steele until January 5th, after that meeting, well after the election. They were not familiar with most of the details of these collusion allegations. They certainly knew nothing about this sort of, you know, raunchy behavior at the Ritz-Carlton that was alleged to have involved Trump. They were only briefed on it on January 5th, 2017, and they were shocked.
But the FBI knew before that, just...
FBI knew, and the FBI had a whole investigation going. But the FBI in the Obama days did not share what it was investigating with the White House, and vice versa. I mean, the Obama, you know, his the defense. Some people have criticized Obama for not, you know, paying more attention to all of this, but his position was, we played by the rules, and the rules were criminal investigations were not supposed to be political matters. The White House stays out of them.
These were quaint times, I suppose.
It's a different era.
Indeed. And so, but when they ultimately found out about it, what happened then? What did they do?
Well, by then, I mean, we're talking in January. When the White House finds out, it's too late to do much. The big question is, what are you going to do about telling Donald Trump that there is this dossier floating around that has this incredibly damning information about him? It's not a product of the FBI. It's not a product of the CIA, but it's been given to the FBI and helped. It's one of the things that the FBI is investigating. So and it's also, by then, a lot of reporters had heard about it. So the FBI is afraid that Trump's going to break out in the open, and they feel they have to tell Trump about it. But who wants to tell somebody that there's this explosive and incredibly embarrassing information about him that's floating around Washington? So
when did it become such an open secret in Washington? Because the press, as you said, press knew about it for a long time. You knew about it for a while, right?
Well, so as of the end of the summer of, you know, while the sort of presidential campaign is raging, the end of the summer, Fusion, the group in Washington, begins to start to try to brief a few reporters on this information. And Steele himself, I met him at the very end of the summer in 2016. And the reason they're beginning to talk to reporters is they are... Steele, in particular, I could see when I met him, he's very proper and very careful, but he's also distraught over what he thinks is the Russians interfering in the United States election. He's watching. By then, there have been leaks of the Democratic National Committee's emails. There's sort of growing sense that the Russians may be interfering in the social media about the campaign, and they're trying to warn reporters, something's up here. You guys need to look into this. But he's being careful. He's not telling the whole story. He's trying to cover his sources. He's trying to not, you know, be out of his lane. He certainly doesn't mention that there's an FBI investigation. He's just saying, you know, pay attention. You know, the Russians are trying to hurt the United States. They're trying to hurt NATO. He sees sort of the big global picture, and he's warning us. And it was very hard to know what to do with these warnings, though.
Why? I mean, briefly, because we do have to wrap up, but why didn't you write about it then at the time?
So I'm a political reporter in Washington, an investigative reporter too, but I know nothing about Russia. So I'm listening to this Russian expert talking about all of these Russian figures, and I'm just not sure what to make of it. I actually luckily at The New Yorker, there are some Russian experts. And so what I did was I turned the material over to them, and we started to try to look into things like Paul Manafort, who was one of the figures. He was a campaign manager for Trump who seems to been very tied into a lot of Russian business and Ukrainian business. So we tried to follow up, but it was hard. There was a learning curve. It seemed kind of almost unbelievable at the time. Now we look back and we think, well, oh my God, what a story. But it was, you know, it was hard to imagine at the time. We tried, and we probably should have done better. But that's why the story about Steele is so interesting, because he's basically the man, he's Cassandra. He's the man with the bad news. He's the messenger that has now been shot, or they're trying to shoot. But he was the guy who was trying to warn the United States.
It is a remarkable story. I've been speaking with New Yorker staff writer Jane Mayer about her story in the March 12th issue, The Man Behind the Dossier. Jane, thanks so much for joining me today.
Great to be with you.